I saw that some of you have got registered for the Mastering Chemistry site. That's good. If you haven't yet, I would strongly encourage you do that before the end of this week. Get in there. Let's get at least get starting to work on the Chapter 1 problems. We'll be dealing with a good amount of Chapter 1 material today, so it's good to go in Mastering Chemistry and at least start taking a look at those problems while they're still fresh in your mind. Right? So, if you haven't logged in yet, if you go to the course webpage, I have all the login information. I have a link to all that. So upcoming due date. So you have until a week from Friday to finish chapter one. I had to give a due date for the intro one, but it doesn't matter. That one's just for practice. So I do recommend you do that intro assignment if you have not used Mastering Chemistry before. So that gets you used to how to enter the right kind of stuff, right kind of format. So have the chapter one assignment due, have that done by a week from Friday, chapter two, a couple Fridays after that, chapter three. So I usually put these things up three at a time. The chapters one through three material will be what's on the first exam. So that's usually how I group those things. So the first lab, that's due on Monday. Labs will always be due on Mondays right before the lab starts. So I have the D2L Dropbox all set up in the D2L course, all ready to go. You can upload it into there as soon as you finish it. Remember, the labs are by pairs, so only one of you needs to submit it. But make sure to see the lab report submission guidelines. So I handed that sheet out to you. If you lose it, it's on my webpage too. But give a quick read through that to make sure you haven't missed anything before you do the submission. That tells you how to name the file. That tells you how to upload it. It tells you need to type your name and your partner's name in the little comment box when you upload the file. That way I have a easy way to tell who that uploaded file belongs to. Okay. So, alrighty. The spreadsheet one. It's not a formal lab report. We didn't really talk much at all about how formal lab reports are. Just follow the directions. It's just an Excel file that you'll be submitting. So you'll have a couple of sheets to it, but just that one Excel file is all you need for this one. Okay. Anybody have questions about either of those things, Mastering Chemistry or spreadsheet one? Any questions? Good. Yeah?
For spreadsheet one, do you have all the tables on the same sheet? Does it have to be on different?
It makes it easiest for me if they're on sheet one, sheet two, sheet three, like it says to do. So that way I can have everybody's sheet two up all at once and look through them. So if you put them all in one, just make a new sheet and then copy and paste it. Oh, okay. Yeah. And by the way, if you already submit something to a Dropbox, you can submit it again. I'll always just accept whatever the most recent submission is. So it would actually make things easier on me if you put it on the separate sheets like it asks you to and then just resubmit it. And I'll just count the most recent one. Okay? Good. Other questions? Yes. Oh, is that on the syllabus? Ignore any mention of WebAssign. Yeah, where did it say that on the syllabus? Last page. We used to use WebAssign before Mastering Chemistry, so.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. So, masteringchemistry.com. Thought I found all of those, guess not. All right. Yes?
So we are supposed to do these 7?
Yeah, I would strongly recommend that you do them. I will not collect them. Those are for your own practice, but all of those ones that I assigned have the answers in the back of the book, so you can check your work. I found there's a pretty strong correlation between the students that do well in this course and students that really diligently work on those practice problems. So I picked out the ones that I think are appropriate to the material that we're covering. So that's an excellent way to do the practicing. I would actually recommend that you try some of those before you do the Master in Chemistry. Right? Just since the Master in Chemistry is worth points, and you can do the ones in the textbook, however you like, to check your answer with those. Okay. Other questions? Last item here, I have discussions open on D2L, so log into the D2L course if you have not yet. If you'd like, introduce yourself to the rest of the class, just a fun little way of making a post. But you do need to have at least one post per chapter in the chapter discussions. Okay? So the introduce yourself thing is just sort of for fun. That doesn't count for anything. What counts is that you have one thoughtful post in each chapter's discussion. Okay? So that can be a question. It can be about our lecture material. It can be about the reading. It can be about the Master in Chemistry assignment. Okay? You can ask a question. You can respond to one of your classmates. The only thing that I ask is that if it's Mastering Chemistry related, that you do not just give the answer out right away. Obviously, you can sort of guide your classmates in the right direction, offer hints, say maybe what you thought of to help you figure it out. But if I see something that has just a straight out answer to it, then I'll probably just delete it. So, okay. So keep that in mind, though, as you're studying this Chapter 1 material. There's not going to be any of you in here where every last thing in this chapter is totally crystal clear. I mean, this Chapter 1 stuff should be review, but there should be at least something that'll make you think a little bit. So, does that work for everybody? All right. Let's start out our first bit of actual chemistry, real chemistry in here. Let's talk about matter, the states of matter, how to classify matter. Okay, so matter is just that big overarching definition, and matter has two properties. What are the two properties of matter? It has mass, and it has volume. Okay, matter has mass and volume. So the mass should be pretty obvious. That's like the definition of matter, right? Mass is the measure of how much matter something. Mass and volume. So it has some sort of substance to it, and it takes up space. Okay. Matter is the part of the universe that has mass and volume. Energy is something else. Energy is, and we'll talk about energy later on. So matter and energy are sort of the two major categories of things that we talk about in this class. Okay. So mass and volume. And so what I have on this diagram here are pictures of the three physical states of matter. Okay. We can take a look at this. In this one, these little spheres, we pretend those are the atoms or the molecules or whatever it is that's making up the substance that we're talking about. So how would you describe the atoms? Let's just call these atoms. How would you describe the way these atoms are set up in that first one? What would you say about that? Yeah, they're close. They're very close together. That's right. What's that? They're uniform. Okay. Structured. They're all in a nice order. Okay. What about the next one? What about the middle one? What would you say about those? A little bit of space between them. Okay. How's that second one? What are other ways that second one's different from the first? Yeah. Unstructured, they're all messed up. They're actually all moving. Let me just draw a little bit here. Let's draw some arrows to indicate that all the atoms are moving. They're all scurrying around. Okay? So, if you've ever seen the inside of a beehive, where all the bees are all clustered all together, but they're all moving around. They're going all kinds of directions. That's what that's representing. And the third one, how's the third one different? lot more space in between. You said they're free, meaning they're not clustered up next to each other. What's that? Compressible. Okay, so we'll talk about that. We even showed some little motion blurs here to show that they're moving very fast. Okay. What's this first one a picture of? Yep, that's a solid. The second one is a... And the third is... Yes. Okay. So, what I would like us to do with those pictures and with those descriptions that we had, let's get ourselves into groups for just a couple minutes. We can rearrange a little bit, I guess. So have a group of four and then another group of four there. What should we do here? Oh, we can rearrange a little bit. That's not a big deal. Let's do a group of three. Okay. A group of four and a group of four. Okay. So why don't you get into your groups, complete this table here for solid, liquid, and gas, and decide whether they're rigid or fluid, decide whether they're compressible or not, and in this third column, show how it is, just describe with each other how it is that those pictures up there led you to believe whether things were rigid or fluid or compressible or not. Okay? So that's what I mean by molecular view. How do those pictures tell you this stuff? So take just a couple of minutes, come up with your opinions, and then we'll go around and discuss. So just a minute, we should be able to get think of it in terms of, go off of what those pictures were. Pictures are come up here so I can write. So let's just sort of go around, and we'll just go at these one at a time. But let's see here. The group in the back over there, what'd you say for a solid? Is a solid rigid or fluid? What do you mean? Yep. I'm gonna say rigid. Anybody disagree? Solids are rigid, right? If something's a solid, it holds its shape well, right? That's what rigid means, okay? Group in the front. Relatively speaking, amongst these, and based on the information you're given there, are solids compressible? You guys in the front, what do you think? No? Anybody disagree with that? No? Are we all in agreement that solids are non-compressible? Yeah, I think that's fine. You guys in the front here. Let's start with rigid and fluid. What is it about? What is it about that first picture? Somebody up in here. What is it about that first picture that would tell you that a solid is rigid instead of fluid? Yeah, it's structured. It's Its atoms are evenly distributed, right? Are the atoms moving here? Little bit. They're vibrating in place, but are they flying all over the place? No. So let's call them locked in place. Structured. That's why solids are rigid. Okay. We agreed that solids are not compressible. You three back there. What is it about that picture that would tell you that a solid is not compressible? Yeah, there's no room. They're tightly packed. That's right. Let's just say close packed. So, this is an exercise that we'll do quite a bit. Thinking of these rigid and compressible, rigid and non-compressible, those are properties of actual substances that we can observe ourselves. Okay? This molecular view is the way the molecules behave, and it's actually these molecular events, these molecular properties that influence the properties of the substances overall. Right? So, it's your turn. Liquid, rigid or fluid? Fluid. That makes sense, right? Liquids are fluid, sure. What does it mean if something is fluid as opposed to being rigid? Yeah, it flows, it moves. If you put it in a container, it'll, in at least some dimensions, take on the shape of a container. So, liquids are fluid. Let's go to the group in the back, over there. Did you guys say that liquids are compressible or not? You said yes? Anybody disagree?
Yeah. It seems like they're not supposed to be, but it kind of looks like
they're. Okay. What do you guys think?
Certain liquids can be compressed, others can't be.
Certain liquids can be compressed. Can you think of an example of a compressible liquid? What do you think? Put water under pressure in a squirt gun. Mm-hmm. Okay. But is it only liquid that's in a squirt gun? Has anybody seen the, it's kind of a bar trick or a demonstration or something like that. If you take a beer bottle or something like that that's totally full and you smack it on top with the hammer, then the bottom will go flying right out of it. That's because if you got the liquid and if you got it totally full so the liquid's curving up over the top, you hit that with a hammer, if a liquid was compressible, would the bottom go flying out of it? I don't think so. Liquids are not compressible. That's why I was interested to see if anyone knew an example of a compressible liquid, because I don't. So, the fact that liquids are not compressible is what allows hydraulics to work. So, a hydraulic pump pushes a liquid into a reservoir. It applies some force to a liquid. And then that force is applied to something else. So depending on the size of the piston, you can have a pretty small hydraulic pump that's able to lift an entire car up to get under it or something like that, or lift an elevator or something like that. So. Well, and we might talk a little bit about how applying pressure can change something for the most part. But if we're just thinking about a liquid being a liquid for the most part, there are, I suppose, forcing conditions that you could literally try to get those molecules to squeeze a little bit tighter together. But for the most part, if we're talking liquids that are staying liquids, I think we're talking non-compressible. So, I don't know, I lost track. I'll just see you guys up here. What about the molecular view of that? It says that liquids are fluid. Yeah, there's movement. It's the opposite of right here. Solid was locked in place. The liquid is moving freely. The molecules are moving freely anyway, right? What would be the part of the view up there that would tell you that liquids are non-compressible? Let's go up here. What do you think? I think a solid was not compressible. What are you for up here? That seems like they're right. In liquids, and it might actually be a little deceptive because it looks like there's empty space here, but there's actually going to be about the same amount of empty space in between those solid particles. It's just these are oriented. If you would turn that solid a little bit to the side, you'd be able to see all the way down that cavity. There would be an empty space. Here we're just seeing that empty space in regions as opposed to being evenly distributed like that. So liquids are still... atoms or molecules are still very close together. In relative terms, at least compared to a gas anyway, what do you suppose that would mean about the density of solids and liquids? They're pretty close. Okay? Different substances will have different densities. One will be a little more dense than another, but in terms of comparing to gases, they're pretty close. So, three back there. Are gases rigid or fluid? Yeah. So the gases are fluid. Over here, are gases compressible? Yes. So, fluid, same reason, moving freely. In the back on my left. What is it about the structure of gases that make them compressible? They're not closely packed. What is in between this gas molecule and that gas molecule? What is it? Yeah, that's nothing. That's empty space. So if I push on a gas, if I compress it, all I'm doing is pushing those molecules closer together. There's nothing really that prevents that. So, other than the gas's own motion that makes them tend to spread apart. So, moving freely, far apart. Right? So, we'll keep that sort of stuff in mind as we're going forward. Any questions about that? Here's another bit about liquids that were compressible. Anybody know how your brakes work in your car? You know, right? There's a pump in the engine. When you push down on the brake pedal, that pump revs up and it pumps brake fluid to these the caliper, the thing that squeezes the brake pads together. So it's pumping fluid to your wheels to squeeze the brake pads together. How would brakes work if liquids were compressible? Right? If the pump revved up, then it would just compress the liquid rather than squeezing those brake pads together. So the fact that liquids are incompressible is what allows that to happen. So here's our big flow chart, same one straight from the textbook, that allows us to classify matter. So, first thing we ask ourselves, do we have variable composition or not? Do we have fixed composition or variable? And that just means for a certain substance, are there different recipes for it? Are there different ways to make it? A percentage of this and a percentage of that, two parts this, two parts that. If it's a mixture, you can have different recipes and still call it the same stuff. If it is a pure substance, there is only one way for it to be. Pure substances have really no variations in their composition. There's not this kind of pure substance and then that kind of pure substance based on their makeup, based on their recipe. They're totally the same. So let's start with pure substances. Is a pure substance separable into simpler substances by normal means? If we can't separate it into anything simpler, then it's an element. And elements have all the same kind of what? Atom. So in this sample of helium, that is just a whole lot of helium atoms, and all those helium atoms are the same. So there are isotopes, and we'll talk about those later, but they are all helium atoms. So if we have a substance, and if I undergo a chemical reaction, use RxN, to either separate it into a simpler substance, then what we started with was a compound. So I'm actually going to write chemical reaction right here. So chemical reactions can turn a compound into elements, or an element into, or elements into compounds, or compounds into other compounds. And we'll talk about the specifics of that. But what can you say about the types of atoms in a compound? Like pure water, for instance, is a compound. It's the same, let's say the same ratio. Of atoms. Water is H2O, so there's always going to be twice as many hydrogens as oxygens if it's pure water. And if it's perfectly pure water, there will be exactly twice as many hydrogens as oxygens. And there's no variation on that. That's a fixed composition. So over here, in variable compositions in the land of mixtures, we just ask ourselves whether it's uniform throughout or not, whether everything is totally, completely mixed up. If I took a sample from one part, I would be completely assured that that would be just the same as a sample from any other part, right? So heterogeneous means that it's not uniform throughout. So look at this wet sand. Got some sand, all kinds of other junk here, but got some water up here. There are different regions. I could take a region of the water. I could take a region of the sand. I could find a big pebble or a small pebble. It's a heterogeneous mixture. Homogeneous mixtures have another name. Anybody know what that's called? This tea with sugar, yeah, that's a solution. Where everything is totally mixed up. If I had some tea and all I did was just dump sugar in it, have I made a homogeneous mixture? Yeah, I haven't. Why not? Yeah. If I dump sugar in it, it'll just settle to the bottom. What do I have to do to make a solution, usually? Yeah, you have to mix it up so that that sugar does what? Yeah. Dissolving needs to occur for a solution to make. For a solution to form. So, let's write that word dissolve. So, use that information and use what you already know about a lot of these substances in your groups and figure out whether all of these things are elements, compounds, heterogeneous, or homogeneous mixtures. So, take just a second and make your way through that list there. Well, let's see what we got. We can have some debates on some of these if we need to. Let's just go in order. Group in the back. Sugar. What'd you say? Compound? Anybody disagree? We're good? How do you know sugar's a compound? Say that louder. It can be broken down, okay. So, yeah, you can burn it and you can get carbon out of it. That's what turns black. So, it's obviously not an element if you can just do a reaction to break it into something else. So, it's a compound. How do you know it's not a mixture? Well, you can have confectioner's sugar and granulated sugar. It's always the same ratio, I heard somebody say. Sugar is, anybody know the chemical name of sugar? Sucrose? As a formula, C12H22O11. So, as long as we've been assured that the sugar is pure, then sugar, sucrose, is an actual compound. Yes, yeah, it can undergo chemical reactions to make it into different compounds. That's right, but that's still a compound. Sugar's ratio is of those elements. Okay, so iron. Element? Anybody think iron is anything else? I didn't specify it, but yeah, I like element for iron. It's Fe on the periodic table. What if iron's rusty? The rust is a compound, it's iron oxide. The whole thing will be what? Okay, I like it. So, in the front, carbon dioxide. In the back on the aisle there, salt water. Solution? What kind of mixture? Homogeneous? Homogeneous mixture is the same thing as a solution. That works. Oh, what did you say for gravel? No matter what, if you take a sample from one part of gravel, you're going to get something different from somewhere else. Powdered Kool-Aid in the back. Heterogeneous? If you spread that out on a table on a black surface and looked at it with the magnifying lens, you'd see little bits of red stuff, you'd see granules of sugar, you'd see other kind of powders. There's all kinds of stuff in there that you cannot be assured has been evenly mixed. So, in the front, what about mixed Kool-Aid when you make it into a, homogeneous solution? Because what did I say is the process that has to happen for a homogeneous mixture? Before? It has to be dissolved. All right, group in the front, vodka. Homogeneous. It is a mixture of ethanol and water, and you know it's homogeneous because different types of vodka may have different percentages, they may have different proofs to them, right? You got good ones and you got not so good ones. So, a homogeneous mixture, absolutely. Back left, tap water. Yeah, let's talk about that. If you got dirty, murky water where stuff actually settles out of it, that can make a heterogeneous. So, I hope you don't drink too much of it. Okay, that's good. Deionized water. Deionized water is a compound. What's in common with all the compounds that I wrote up here? Every compound has a chemical formula that describes it. So if it's a compound, it has a certain fixed ratio of elements to it that describes it perfectly. If I have indeed a pure sample of carbon dioxide, I will have exactly twice as many oxygens as I have carbons, for instance. So, that makes sense to everybody? All right. Moving right along. Physical changes and chemical changes. The difference between a physical change and a chemical change. Well, let's take a look at some dry ice here. I'll bring in some dry ice one of these days when I get a chance to. It's there's a picture of it, block of white stuff that has vapors that are sort of coming off of it. What happens with dry ice? It spontaneously changes from solid to gas. Anybody remember what that phase change is called from solid to gas? Carbon dioxide readily undergoes sublimation. Have I changed the actual substance that's present? I have CO2 solid. I have CO2 gas. In both cases, I still have CO2, correct? I have a compound in the bottom. I have the same compound after it has sublimed. So anybody know what kind of change that is? Is that a physical change or a chemical change? Compare it down here. I have solid sugar. I dump it into a container of water and I stir it around. I end up with dissolved sugar molecules. The phase label changed. There's a formula of solid. There's a formula of AQ that means it was dissolved in water. It's aqueous. Think to yourself, do I have the same substances present? Have I made any different substances? Before you answer that, this one on the bottom. In our little camping stove here, I have a tank filled with propane, C3H8. When anything burns, it turns into carbon dioxide and water, ideally. That's a combustion reaction. Do I have the same substances present, or have I made different substances? C3H8 is what I started with. CO2 and H2O are two compounds that C3H8 has changed into by reacting with oxygen in the air. So I have three things on this page. Sublimation, the dissolving, the combustion. There are physical changes and chemical changes. Which of these is unlike the other two? Yeah, the bottom one is unlike the other two. We formed new compounds here. Same. One where I take something, I maybe rearrange it a little bit, but I have all those same compounds present. What do you think? Is that a physical change or a chemical change? That's a physical change.
Okay. That's the definition, really, of a physical change.
When I have the same compounds, when I have all the same substances, when I have solid sugar, how would you be able to tell that all that same sugar, all those same sucrose molecules are still present in salt water, or in the sugar water there? Yeah, if you taste it, what's sugar water going to taste like? It tastes like sugar. That's because all that sugar is still there. Nothing changed. All that happened was those same sugar molecules just sort of spread themselves out in the water. All that happened up here is we went from CO2 that was all solid, all lined up, locked together, into molecules that are just flying away. Same molecules, though. Down here, propane molecules, the atoms in those molecules rearranged into different compounds. So I have these specific propane molecules. I have CO2 molecules. I have H2O molecules. Okay? This is a chemical change. All right. Any questions about that? I'm trucking. Let's have a little discussion about energy. Remember, I told you there are two parts to the universe, pretty much, in terms of chemistry anyway. The physicists have more things to describe. But for chemistry, there's matter, the stuff with mass and volume, and then there's energy, other stuff. So energy is just the capability, it's just right there. Energy is the capability to do work. And in science, work has a very specific definition. It's not just you're going to get your hours in, you know, punch your timesheet or something like that. Work has a very specific meaning in the sciences anyway. But energy is that capability. So there are several types of energy that we'll talk about, but what they all have in common is just some sort of ability let's define work here. People here have taken physics, right? Who's taken physics? You guys. I'm moving back there, a couple of you guys. Remember what the real definition of work is from physics? Yep, absolutely right. So that's the fundamental definition of work. Right? Thinking about lifting an object, right? Pulling on a pulley to lift something by a certain distance. So you're exerting a force over a certain distance. That's a definition of work. But it's not just a person, you know, pulling up a weight or shoving a box or something like that. It can be an atom that's moving over a certain distance, a force that's applied to an atom or a molecule or something like that. It could be one molecule changing into a different molecule. There are forces and distances that are required there. So it's just the effective way that things are modified, things are manipulated, things are changed. So we'll discuss work a little more in the thermal chemistry chapter. So let's talk about energies, though. So all of these are different ways that we can, ways that we can describe the capability to perform some kind of action. Let's put it that way. I think that's a nice way to put it. So potential energy can be, I don't have a real definition, but it can be based on position, so if we're just talking about position-wise, what has more potential energy? Use a weight or something. That's something we can see. Oh, potential. Let's think about these lights that are hanging sort of precariously up above that. What has more potential energy? One of those that's just sitting on the floor, or one of those that's up on that thing up there? Kind of. Yeah. The one that's up there has a lot of potential energy. because it has capability to do something that the one on the floor doesn't. What can that one do that the one on the floor can't? It can fall and it can break. Right? All of that involves a large amount of energy that's being transferred. So that's what potential energy based on position is. So just based on the difference of how gravitational force can affect something. That's the classic view of potential energy. In chemistry, potential energy can also be based on composition. So, depending on what a certain substance is made of, it can have more or less potential energy. If we're thinking of a certain type of reaction, let's think of combustion reactions again. What has more potential energy towards a combustion reaction? A container of alcohol or a container of water? The alcohol has more potential energy based on its composition. So fuels are based entirely on this idea. An effective fuel has a large amount of potential energy that can be accessed when that fuel is combusted, when it's burned. So the gasoline that goes in your car, the natural gas that powers your furnace, the potential energy of those is what is able to heat your home or move your car. So that's actually a pretty good example when we're talking moving your car. The potential energy in the gasoline has the capability of causing your car to be pushed over a certain distance. Okay. So kinetic energy, I bet some of you might know this. Kinetic energy is the energy of what? Motion. So, if I have a substance with a large amount of kinetic energy, that has a capability of doing more work than something that does not. So, a steamroller that's going that way towards that wall has the capability to destroy that wall, to push the components of that wall out of the way. It can do work on that wall. Whereas a steamroller that's just sitting still does not have that capability. So kinetic energy can be used to do work. Thermal energy, let's think of that in terms of heat. And heat is just the way that, heat is just one way that energy is transferred. We'll go into a lot more detail about how that works later on. Say that a little louder. Light being created. Light can be created by giving off energy. So electromagnetic radiation, I guess, itself is not really matter. It's more in terms of energy. So we'll talk a good amount about electromagnetic radiation too. That's sort of its own sort of class of substances, right? So chemical energy is just this up here, right? It's the type of potential energy that's contained in molecules. Chemical energy of a fuel. Right? Rocket fuels, for instance, have a very large amount of chemical energy compared to something like gasoline or something like that. So, something that is explosive has a very large amount of chemical energy, and that chemical energy is what is released in order to cause an explosion, for instance. So, let's any questions about energy? That's just a matter of familiarity with those at these points. We'll have an entire chapter on a couple of those later on. Okay. So let's talk about how some measurements are made. You've all taken some sort of course in the past that's introduced you to these, so we won't dwell on them too much. But I'll just show you here the SI units. Those are just the standard metric units And in terms of how the measurement works, what is common between every kind of metric unit? So you can measure lots of metric units on some type of scale. What's common between any kind of metric scale? Yeah, everything is broken into 10 subdivisions. T's look like F's with this sometimes. So we can take a meter, divide it into 10 and get decimeters, divide that into 10 and get centimeters, and so on. We can do that exact same thing with any SI unit. So these are the fundamental SI units that we'll be using. There are actually a couple of other ones, like the unit of charge and things like that. But we'll be using these ones most commonly. So the meter, the kilogram, the second, the Kelvin, as measurements of length, mass, time, and temperature. So let's actually start with temperature. So, don't say anything out loud. Try to complete that sentence in your head. Temperature is the measure of... Did any of you have the word heat in your head? Sorry. Heat is a transfer of energy. And heat, that transfer of energy, is governed by temperature changes. So heat and temperature are they're sort of related, but they're very distinct things. And we'll talk about that quite a bit in the thermochemistry chapter. So scratch off heat. Heat is not what we're measuring when we measure the temperature. Think back to our molecular views at the beginning. If I have a cold liquid and if I have a hot liquid, what will be the difference between those two samples? Yeah. So what is temperature the measure of? What's that? Kinetic energy. Temperature is very closely related to kinetic energy. It's proportional, actually. Let's just say temperature is the measure of molecular motion. Give you an equation later on that equates temperature with kinetic energy. It's a directly proportional relationship. So, we'll put heat on hold for a little bit. Heat is how energy is transferred from one place to another. Temperature is just based on one substance itself, how fast its molecules are moving. So, let's keep that in our head. So, got the Kelvin scale. Got the degree Celsius. This really should be lowercase if I'm being meticulous. So the name of any unit is in lowercase, even if its abbreviation is capital. So think about that one for a little bit. Anybody know another word that's sometimes used for this one? Yeah. Celsius is actually now the proper name for that unit. So according to SI rules, that unit is called the degree Celsius. So some people, especially people in England and places like that, like to call it centigrade, but the proper scientific term for it is Celsius. Centigrade is a little bit deprecated, a little bit old-fashioned. So let's talk about these two scales. Something special about Kelvin, specifically zero Kelvin. What's that? And if temperature is a measure of molecular motion, what happens at absolute zero? The problem with that is that for a molecule to be completely still and completely isolated, there has to be nothing that's able to feed energy into it. And based on laws of thermodynamics that we'll talk about later, it's a complete impossibility. There's no way to totally isolate something from the outside world. It's impossible. There's always going to be some way that some energy will get in and start it moving a little bit. Even if we could theoretically try to stop it, something would just start it moving again. So using lasers and magnetic fields and stuff, they can try to force molecules to get slower and slower and slower in their little vibrations. So they keep going by more and more powers of 10, getting closer to absolute zero, but we'll never reach absolute zero. According to laws of thermodynamics, it'll be impossible just due to that isolation issue. So what's interesting, though, is that the Kelvin and the degree Celsius are the same size scale. They're just shifted. So a difference of 10 degrees Celsius is the same as a difference of 10 Kelvin. 1 degree Celsius is the same size of unit as 1 Kelvin. So that makes the conversion between those pretty simple. It's just a matter of adding. So what's absolute zero in degrees Celsius? Yeah, minus 273.15, 0 Kelvin. And we'll talk unit conversion in a little bit, but it turns out that 1 Kelvin is equal to 1 degree Celsius. But then the scale is shifted by 273.15. So 0 Celsius is 273.15 Kelvin. 25 Celsius, which is about usually how we describe room temperature, that's going to be 298.15 Kelvin, just by adding 25 to that. So we should all be able to do that. Degrees Celsius is Kelvin minus 273.15, just rearranging that one, so no big deal there. The degree Fahrenheit scale has a little more of an added complication to it. So Fahrenheit scale is pretty unique to the U.S. and a couple of other countries, and even in the U.S., it's only used pretty much outside of science. So in chemistry, we'll be using degrees Celsius and Kelvin pretty much exclusively. We'll be using degrees Celsius pretty much exclusively in lab. All of our thermometers are in degrees Celsius. There are several calculations that we'll need to do that need to be in Kelvin. So be equally familiar with those. The problem with the Fahrenheit scale is that there's two issues. So what I have here is the fundamental equation between those two. There's going to be a simpler one, which I'll show you in a second, but let me show you how this one works. If I have a value in degrees Celsius, what does this mean? 9 degrees Fahrenheit divided by 5 degrees Celsius. Why would I have something like that? What's that compensating for? Kelvin and Celsius have the same what? Same size of unit. By doing that, I'm saying that what? Yeah, there's a different size of unit. Which is bigger, a degree Fahrenheit or a degree Celsius? Yeah. There are 9 degrees Fahrenheit for every 5 degrees Celsius. So run that through the gears a little bit. Over the same temperature range, there would be 9 degrees Fahrenheit and there would be 5 degrees Celsius. So the degrees Celsius are bigger units because there would be 9 Fahrenheits fit in where 5 Celsius would be. Okay? So this is essentially just what changes the size of the unit. That part. And then plus 32 there changes where 0 is. So that means if we're at 0 Celsius, right, just multiplying 0 is just 0 in here, but we still have to add 32 to get into Fahrenheit. So the 0 points are at different places for Celsius and Fahrenheit. So so how did they decide what 0 Celsius was? What's special about 0 Celsius? Yeah, water freezes at 0 Celsius. Yeah. Freezing or melting point. Just depends on which direction you're coming at it. Same temperature as long as it's pure water. It could be 0 degrees Celsius or something very close to it. 0 degrees Fahrenheit. The story of the Fahrenheit scale is pretty interesting. Kelvin, Celsius, and Fahrenheit, they were all three scientists in Europe 200 or so years ago, and they were all working at making colder and colder temperatures. So there was a time when having cold temperatures was something that either only happened in winter or maybe never happened at all in certain places. So getting things like ice and then eventually figuring out how to compress and expand gases in order to change temperatures that way and make refrigeration units and so on, they were able to get colder and colder temperatures. So those three were pioneers in the field of making things cold. Fahrenheit set his 0 at what in his time was pretty much the coldest temperature. So 0 Fahrenheit. And what he did, he took ice water and he saturated it with salt. So he put as much salt in it as would dissolve and more. So 0 Fahrenheit is actually the freezing point of saturated salt water. And plus it was a convenient scale for him at the time because not a lot went colder than that. So, and then he set 100 to be about equal to what? What's a fundamental temperature that's somewhere around 100? What do you think? Yeah, it's around body temperature. So as accurately as they could measure it back then, body temperature was 100. Fahrenheit. So that's where that scale came from. But there's two things that are different with that. 0 is at a different place, and the range, right, the number of degrees between water freezing and water melting is different. So the size of the unit is different. So there's a little easier way, I think, to deal with that. Right. Fahrenheit. Yeah. So 9/5 is 1.8, right? So 1.8 times 1.8 times, that's a lot easier to look at than something like that is, right? And then if I want to solve that for degrees Celsius, what's the first bit of algebra that you would do in order to get degrees Celsius alone by itself on one side? What would you do first? Minus 32, yeah. We have to get rid of this 32. So let's do degrees Fahrenheit minus 32. And with parentheses, to make sure we do that first, then what do I have to do? Divide by 1.8. Right? So these equations will be given on the conversion sheet. Quizzes and exams. In other words, don't waste your time memorizing those, but if you are presented with something that looks like that, you should be able to solve those. We're not gonna take time and work those out. You can you're perfectly capable of working on problems in the textbook like that until you're with those, right? So again, these equations, along with the Kelvin equation, right, that 273.15, those will be given to you. So make sure you know how to use them. If you need to go from Kelvin to Fahrenheit, you have to go by way of what? Celsius. So you have to do two steps. All right. Let's end today's talk with just a little introduction to metric prefixes. Remember we said the neat thing about the metric system is that everything is in powers of 10. So everything gets divided into 10, or we can group 10 of a unit together to get a new unit. So these metric prefixes are what will modify a certain unit. So let's start with what's called a base unit. And base unit has no prefix. So shout out an example of a metric unit that is just a base unit. Meter, that's the one that everybody comes up with. What else?
Gram,
yeah. Liter. Things like that. Second. Okay. So, no prefix in front of it. That's sort of the starting point for the metric system. Now, we've got two directions that we're going here. Right? I have kilo and mega going one way. Deci, centi, milli, micro, nano, pico going the other way. Kilo and mega do what to the size of the unit? Do they make a unit smaller? It larger? Yeah. Kilo makes it larger by 1,000. Mega makes it larger by 1,000,000. Makes unit larger. Which means going this other way makes the unit smaller. Okay. It will be especially helpful if you memorize these. A little better. So the name is symbol, and I think it would be most useful for us to consider what power of 10 it is. That's going to be much more convenient for us than for instance dividing by 0.00000001, right? So let's deal with powers of 10. Deci makes a unit smaller by 1 power of 10, centi by 2, milli by 3. Micro, check out this symbol here, that is mu, Greek letter mu. So micro will make a unit smaller by 6 powers of 10, nano, pico, and there's lots of other ones. What's the next one, 3 powers of 10 bigger than mega? Giga, yeah. If you know about your computer's hard drive, you know about giga, and then you also know about it's after giga by 3 tera, right? So we don't need to worry too much about giga and tera in chemistry. We really don't even deal with mega that much either. So, but things like nano, pico, micro are very important to us because the size of atoms, right, the size of nuclei, the size of particles can be given in nanometers or picometers. The size of waves of light, the wavelength of waves of light is almost always given in nanometers. These are convenient units to use when we're describing things that are really small. So, and they're really pretty easy to deal with as long as you keep a couple of basic things in mind. First of all, those positive powers of 10 make the unit larger, the negative make the unit smaller, and wherever we see one of these prefixes, that power of 10 can be substituted for it. So that micro, that actual symbol itself, can be substituted for 10 to the minus 6. So let's just do that one. Micro equals 10 to the minus 6. So if I have one micrometer, that's how many meters? Yeah, that's one times, essentially just 10 to the minus 6, right? Look what I did. Here's the micro, here's the power of 10.
what he said. Let's just make it 1 times 10 to the minus 6. A little difference in precision, so we'll just be a little more accurate. So that's an easy way to start dealing with metric prefixes. If you see a metric prefix, substitute its power of 10 right in its place. Okay? What if I want to go the other way? What if I want to have 1 meter? And I want to know how many micrometers that is. Is 1 meter 10 to the minus 6 micrometers? Think about it. And if you ever have trouble with this, put it in a scale of something that you can visualize. Here's a meter. Right? Micrometer, tiny, tiny, tiny. Okay? Size of a grain of sand. Right? Tiny grain of powder or something like that. That's a micrometer. So 1 micrometer is a fraction of a meter. Okay? It's 1 millionth, 10 to the minus 6, yeah. 1 millionth of a meter. Right? So 10 to the minus 6 is a small fraction like that. If I have 1 meter, how many micrometers are going to be in it? 10 to the what? 10 to the 6. Swapping the relationship does what to the sign of the exponent? Being the relationship uses the inverse exponent. So 10 to the minus 6 is 1 over 10 to the 6. That's why I called it inverse. So just swapping that relationship. But always keep it in your mind that micro is a small unit. A meter is just the base unit, so that's going to be bigger. Take a look at this. I have 2 units. I have micrometers and meters. Which of these is the larger unit? Micrometer or meter? Meter is the larger unit. Okay? Which of these has the larger number in front of it, though? This one does. 1 is bigger than 10 to the minus 6. Okay? So the larger number went with the smaller unit. Take a look down here. Here's the larger unit. Here's the smaller unit. Oh, the larger number went with the smaller unit. That's always going to be the case when you have a relationship like this set up between 2 metric prefixes. I just want to write that because it's really handy. Larger number goes with the smaller unit. And why is that? If I have a meter, that's the larger unit. But if I'm thinking of the smaller unit, what? I need a lot of those smaller units. So as the unit is larger, I need fewer of them. As the unit is smaller, I need a lot of them to equal that same thing. So you can always check yourself. You can always check. You can double check to make sure you haven't switched a sign or something. In any relationship like that, the larger number will always be going with the smaller unit. That's a really helpful rule of thumb that you can always use to double check that sort of thing. Okay? Questions? Excellent. I think we're at our time. Yep. I think our time is up, so we'll move on. What's next? Volume? Yep. So we'll move on with volume, and we should get most of the way through the rest of Chapter 1 next time. So get a start on the Chapter 1 Mastering Chemistry. So there are questions about units and temperature conversion and stuff like that. Use the stuff that you learned today while it's fresh and try to get at that.